the one hand, I'm making it up as I go along, but on the other hand, I've got no preconceptions as to how we should be doing things. I mean, it is seriously one of the most exciting industries to be in at the moment, and the progression that we could make in this country is huge.
My name is Paul Harvey, and this is Life, Passion and Business. We're about helping you explore, finding your passion for life and the work that you do. But it's so much more than that. It's about finding clues to the big life questions. What does it mean to be successful? What is the meaning of life? If you're looking for more, then join me on this journey, where together we will discover through interviews, tools and tips, how to live life full of meaning, passion and purpose. Hello and welcome to Life, Passion and Business. My guest on today's program is Jock Gibson, and he is a farmer and butcher from Dallas. That's Dallas Forres in the northeast of Scotland, my hometown. I'll get back to Jock in a moment, but first I need to tell you about something that occurred or something that's come up from the last few weeks. So a few weeks back, I did a podcast, number 57, on fear and change. And you'll have heard my conversation with Susie Beaumont. It was an unscheduled conversation that we kind of were talking, and we realized it was so valuable we needed to record it. So we turned it into a Facebook Live, and ultimately it became a podcast. It was all about fear and change. But we were also talking about the Change Your World conference, because that's what we were involved in at the time. Well, the conference was a major success because it brought together into a room some amazing people, all looking to make positive change in their life and in the world. And one of those people, including my wife, as it happens. So, as I said at the time, there would be more. Well, that opportunity is now open to those beyond Scotland. Yes, Change Your World Online launches in just a few days, and Susie pulling in some amazing people. Now, the process will feature and involve daily actions that will take you forward, even if you're like me and you struggle with the concept of goals. So anyway, this process will take you forward. There will be daily actions and accountability and Q&As and all sorts of stuff. And there's some amazing people lined up. So check out the website, which is changeyourworld.me, or you can go to lifepassionandbusiness.com and the links will be on this podcast. That's enough from me about this. Let's get back to farming and Jock Gibson. Now, this conversation is unusual for me because it's not a result of a social media connection. When I arrived here 15 years ago, I became a consultant and did a stint with a local enterprise company, and Jock Gibson was one of my clients. Now, I moved on from that contract many years ago, but Jock and I kept in touch and have remained social media friends. So together with his wife, Fiona, they farm beef cattle native to the Scottish Highlands, and they sell their produce through the family butcher shop, Macbeth's. They supply hotels, restaurants, as well as private individuals up and down the country with their online shop. Now, his business is a vertical business in that he sees the process, he grows the grass, feeds the cows, and right the way to the final finished product in his shop. Jock has become a man of the land. However, originally he studied engineering at Manchester University, and after completing that course, he took a few years sailing, and then he started work for a building services consultancy in Peterborough, but that was not his path. So after another university degree and another engineering job in Glasgow, it was clear that was not his path either. So Jock returned to Dallas to take up the family butchery business, and that is a story in itself. Now, my interest in Jock on the show has been about his dedication and passion for his industry. He says that farming is the most exciting industry to be in at the moment, as there is so much opportunity. And that opportunity came for him in 2015 after the death of his parents. He and Fiona took over the family farm and now live there with their three children. Jock is active in the industry as a board member of the Quality Meat Scotland, as a director for the Farmer Jones Academy, and on the steering committee for the Highlands and Islands Food and Drinks Awards. Our conversation is very different from my previous guests. It's a hands-on, hard job, dealing with the harsh realities. Agriculture, like every business, is facing enormous change. However, they are facing it on every level, with environmental concerns, regulation, and political upheaval. I also wanted on the show, as most of my previous guests were virtual business or service providers, but this is a story here of him and his family and the success and challenges that he faces in what effectively is a very tight market. And while we managed to steer clear of Brexit, sort of, it is almost impossible because it's such a significant issue in his life, as it will affect pretty much everything that he does. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the conversation with Jock Gibson. So welcome to Life, Passion and Business. I am delighted today to be with, I would say an old friend, because I've known Jock for many, many years in various guises. We've been connected at various events that we've seen each other at. So this is Jock Gibson, and I know him as a butcher, but I know he's not a butcher. I know he's far, far more than that. And so I was delighted to invite him on the program because I know that Jock is actually a farmer, and that's a lot of interest in that. So I wanted to see where this conversation would go today, because I think you have to be passionate to be a farmer in the modern world. So Jock, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So tell me, Jock, what's the story? Because I know you didn't start out as a farmer. I know you went to Gordonston, which is a posh school near here, and I know you had a different plan for life, I think, anyway, from our previous conversations.
Yeah, I mean, when I left Gordonston, I went down to Manchester and studied building services engineering, no, mechanical engineering down there with business studies. And that was the direction that I was going to head into. I was going to be an engineer with no particular thought as to what sort of engineering I was going to do. Yeah, that was where I was going, the direction that I was going to head. After leaving university, I bummed around on boats for a bit. I did a stint back at home on the farm because mum wasn't well and dad was away quite a bit. So I did a stint on the farm then. And then I got my first proper job down in Peterborough as a building services engineer. I sort of stayed doing the engineering for about 5 years until I discovered that I wasn't particularly good at it and came back to run Macbeth, which is where I met you.
How did you discover you weren't good at engineering?
It was maybe pointed out to me by one of my project managers. No, I didn't have required eye for detail, I don't think. You know, I would go and design a boiler house system. You know, you'd have various things in there and you'd have, you know, you'd obviously have your boiler, your pipework, and you'd have a myriad of different valves. And I would go and specify a gate valve, and it was pointed out to me that, don't be so stupid, it's a globe valve you needed. And to me, both shut water off, both did roughly the same thing. So what did it matter? And apparently it does matter quite a bit. So it was at that point I sort of discovered that it wasn't necessarily for me.
No, indeed. So did you come back into the family business through choice? Was this a choice? Like, are you made a positive choice to come back into the family business, or?
Yeah, I did make the choice. I approached my parents, who, funnily enough, at the time were actually thinking of selling the butcher shop. I made the approach to come back and take that on. So I think, yeah, I approached them. They both cried for a bit, and then we got on with making that happen.
Was that the joy of cry, joy of tears of coming back, or
no? It was tears of pain. I think from their point of view, you know, they bought a business in the mid '80s, lived and breathed it, you know, 30 odd years, and actually wanted to move on. You know, they'd made the decision to move on from it. I think, you know, that process of making that decision, coming to the conclusion that that was no longer what they wanted to do. They'd made that decision, and then I came along and almost reversed it for them. Looking at back at it with hindsight, I think it would have been a very difficult and painful time for them, because up until that point, it was, you know, it was their business, their thing. They could do what they liked with it. There was no onus on them to have it in a state ready to pass on to the next generation. It was their project, and that was the way it always was.
Yeah.
I think to then maybe change the game plan slightly, yeah, probably was difficult.
So was your family always into farming?
Dad, with his parents, bought the farm in the mid-70s. Up until that point, Dad had been training as an accountant and decided that, you know, it just wasn't for him. So, yeah, he bought the farm in the mid-70s.
Right.
So he was a first-generation farmer, basically.
Okay. Is that a common thing in farming, for people to come into it if they've not been in farming?
I mean, farming generally is a very generational business. It does get handed down and handed down. And actually, for new entrants coming into the industry, it's quite difficult in this country to do because, well, for a whole host of things, mainly because it's a generational business, but access to land, access to resources and facilities is a big barrier. The cost of entry is quite high as well, or significantly high. So it is very much generational businesses. Land ownership laws in this country don't help either. Yeah, new entrants are unusual.
Mm. So where is your passion in all of this? Because obviously you had a passion for an engineer and then you came back to become a butcher. They're very different. They're very different processes.
Yeah, I guess the common thing is starting with something and seeing it right through to the end.
Mm-hmm.
So in the engineering, you would, you know, in the particular line of engineering I did, I was designing heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems for a building. And you'd start off with rough ideas. They would develop into plans that would eventually go to a contractor who would eventually build and install these things.
Yeah.
And at the end of the process, you'd end up with a building which people lived, worked, you know, inhabited. And that's very satisfying. The same is true, and I get to see it now even more that we're up at the farm. The same is true with the farming and the butchery side of it. We start off with, and at the moment we're in the middle of calving, so we are bringing new life onto the farm, which we then care for and look after before taking it through to the butcher's shop and delivering a product to an end customer. So we get to see the whole process the right the way through, which we're very privileged to see. It's not, we're in a minority in the industry that get to do that.
Yes, most people, I guess, most butcher shops are a wholesale or a retail operation from a wholesale purchase, I guess.
Yes, and likewise on the farm side of it, you produce a product up to a point and then you sell it on to the next person in the chain. I mean, you say in farming, you sell it wholesale and buy it retail because you only take it to a point before somebody else processes it into another product, whether that be a steak in the case of a beef farm or Weetabix in the case of a cereal farm.
Right. Yes, of course. I guess in this situation, this is very much a business process. That your success metrics are very much about results in the farm, I guess.
Yeah, we have a number of what we call key performance indicators on the farm, and success is measured by those. Profitability is obviously one success factor, but there's a number of other factors that lead into that. And, you know, that will be things like percentage of calves weaned. More and more we're looking at the amount of grass we can grow and utilize. That's another key success factor, which all filters down into the overall performance indicator, which is profitability at the end of the day.
So where's the success factor for you? I mean, all right, I know we have these kind of sense that success is profitability and those bits and pieces, but there is a greater sense of self-satisfaction from something. What is that for you?
So in my particular case, and I think particularly on the farm, when we inherited the farm nearly 4 years ago, something like that, the farm had been scaled back to a point which was manageable but not necessarily profitable. At the time, my mother wasn't very well, so Dad had scaled back the operations to help look after Mum. When we inherited the farm in 2015, we'd inherited a situation where we had a working farm, we had all the equipment, we had some livestock, but we'd essentially inherited an unprofitable situation because we didn't have the raw material, if you like, to make the business profitable. Over the last 4 years, we have been building that up. And for me, the satisfaction has come from seeing how we've built it up, seeing, and we're by no means there yet, but seeing how we've built it up, seeing the livestock that we have, and probably more importantly, the way in which we are changing the farming operation to be more thoughtful about how we interact with our environment. Mm-hmm. And for me now, that is a key part to our operation. And, you know, whilst I've grown up on the farm, inherited the farm and everything like that, I'm not a farmer by trade. I've got no specific training on that. So on the one hand, I'm making it up as I go along. But on the other hand, I've got no preconceptions as to how we should be doing things. Mm-hmm. Now, we've not radically changed anything, but so nips and tucks, we are changing the way in which we farm. We are determined to use a plough less, for example. We're determined to look after our grass better, and more importantly, our soil health better. And so the satisfaction from that is huge when you can see the little incremental changes that you're making having a real on the ground difference. And some changes we've made have had game-changing effects on the business. And that satisfaction on a professional but personal level is huge.
Can you share one? Because it's a game-changing thing when you say that. It sounds like that sounds exciting. It's like, and your face is lit up on that one. So it's like, what is a game changer for you?
So last year we started. So before last year, in the summer, we would throw all the cows into fields and leave them there for 6 months, hopefully. And if the grass ran out, we would take them out earlier and move them into another place. But we wouldn't do much more than that. Last year, we took a field, we split it up into six individual blocks. And instead of putting, say, 30 cattle into that one whole field, we stuck them into one block. And then after 3 days, we moved them into another block, and so on and so forth, until we've gone all the way around. And that process would take about 3 weeks to get all the way around. The effect of that is that you're giving the grass recovery time. So you're only grazing it for 3 days, 3.5 days. You're going in at a certain height, you're grazing it down, and then you're letting it rest. The effect of that rest period is the grass grows back better, it increases rooting depth, it will thicken up slightly, and overall, you will grow more grass from that process.
And you're concentrating the manure, aren't you? Because they are only in a smaller area, so they're delivering.
You're concentrating the manure and all of that. So you're returning a lot more of the nutrients that you're taking up from the ground back into the ground. The effects of growing all that grass and giving them higher quality grass, because they're always eating the right bit of the grass, is that they grow faster. And without forcing them, without doing anything like that, we brought forward our averaging finishing times for a beast by about 4 months.
That's amazing, actually. That is really exciting to hear that conversation. Is that being done in other places?
Yeah, it's there's farmers up and down the country that are doing it more and more. I would say it's quite big in New Zealand.
And you're improving soil health as well. That must be so good for soil health.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's a slightly longer game. And we've yet to see the effects of that in full. But you know, last year from our last serious rain on this farm was probably May last year. And okay, we had quite a lot of rain last week, but you know, the ground here is still pretty dry. And after mid of June last year, grass just did not grow to anything like it would. But those beasts that we had in that rotation, we always managed to keep grass in front of them. We always managed to keep them growing. And we still brought their finishing time forward. And we by no means got that right. You know, there was so much more we could do to improve what we did last year. Because, I mean, we had, at one point, we had grass that was so high, we just had to cut it. And at other times, the grass was like a bowling green. So, you know, on the amateur scale that we did it, you know, we still had huge, huge results from it. And looking at it this year, it was that ground that we had on rotation, it was the first grass to come back. So, you know, the effects have been amazing.
Do you know, I heard, and I listened to a lot of podcasts, and you and I batted this conversation around a bit, because because this soil health is a really big thing for me. I'm really fascinated by this idea of revolutionizing farming. That's one of the reasons why I talked to you, really. So, but there was someone that there's some evidence that in the 1500s, there was more beef coming out of some areas of America than there is now.
Yeah.
Because of the bison and everything else. And the topsoil when the settlers arrived was 40 feet.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, especially in America, I think, where you've got these huge, you know, Mauritius-sized counties of fields where they are, you know, just going monocropping after monocropping after monocropping. You know, the damage that they have and are doing is huge. And to a certain extent, are we seeing it in this country? Yes, I think we probably are in some areas. But yeah, it's in terms of livestock numbers, again, in the UK, the number of us, well, in Scotland, the number of our suckler cow herd has been declining for about the last 10 years. I don't think we are producing any more beef now than we were 10, 20 years ago. And yet we are being absolutely hauled over the coals in the press for our climate change implications, and that it's always increasing. And actually, I'm not sure that it is. And I think if you want to look at agriculture's impact on the environment and the climate, to farm sustainably in the world, let alone the UK, livestock are going to have to be part of that answer. Okay. Because we look at Scotland, and about 80% of the ground in Scotland is only suitable for farming ruminants. You know, there's large swathes of Scotland where there's no way you could grow barley or wheat. Or if you could, you need to be asking the question whether you should. You know, what are the levels of inputs that you need to put in to produce that crop? I think there's monitor farms in Lothian especially where they have shown and are showing the real power, if you like, of mixed cereal and livestock farming and how you can improve soil health and everything like that.
That's how it used to be. That's how it used to be when there used to be rotation, didn't there? Before fertilizers, yeah. there was a 4-year rotation. That was how it was done.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, you need that mixture of species, of livestock. And you look at Alan Savory, who's done a lot of work in Africa primarily, looking at regenerating huge areas there. He came from a background of basically saying that animals were not the best of things for the environment and for the landscape. And he went on to do quite a bit of research and came to the conclusion of the exact opposite. That, you know, you look at these migratory patterns of animals where they go in, they graze hard and move on. And what that does to the regeneration of the ground, soil health, and building up organic matter in the soil. And the Sabre Institute now is a huge movement in regenerative agriculture and landscape management.
So what else are you, that's fascinating, Jock, that you've had such success with that. You must be quite excited about the year to come with that one.
Yeah, I mean, it's hugely exciting for us and what we might be able to achieve, because it goes back to the situation that we inherited back in 2015, where we were sitting looking at a fixed land mass that we had direct control over, going, well, we actually need an output of this to make it profitable. How do we do it? And, you know, we had two options. One was to build vast amounts of sheds and intensively feed animals, which is not the way I particularly wanted to go. For me, I didn't think it was the right way to go, given our customer base at the end. The other thing was then, the other option was, well, we've got to get more beasts finished off of grass. And so we were looking at how we can intensify how many animals we have on the ground without throwing bags and bags of nitrogen onto the ground, because that would be another way out of it, is just to throw more inputs onto the ground and do it that way. But, you know, again, is that what we should be doing? We could do it, but is it what we should be doing?
And there's a cost implication in that one, I guess.
Yeah, there is a cost implication. But, you know, it's not about stripping out cost for the sake of stripping out cost. It's finding the balance between what we can sustainably support on the ground versus what we can then also put into it. Now, I'm not necessarily going to go organic, which would be to strip out a heap of the inputs that we have. We might get there yet, to be fair, but that's not the immediate direction. But there is definitely a direction is to be more conscious of what we put into the ground versus what we take out of it, and trying to get a better balance at that end.
Mm-hmm. So is this your passion? Is this where it is for you, the excitement of that sort of stuff?
It probably is now. And, you know, I'm conscious of the fact that, you know, I've been at Macbeth's now for, I think it's about 12 years, and up at the farm for 4. So the farm is a bit like the new shiny toy that you have to play with. But equally, agriculture is one of the most exciting industries to be in at the moment. It doesn't matter whether you're into robotics or genetics, or you just want to play with big fancy machinery, there is a job for you in agriculture somewhere along the lines. The research that's going on is amazing. The new technology that is coming through is awesome. And yes, we need people who are going to pick fruit, feed cows, and do all of these things. You know, whether you're very high intellect or very high manual skills, there is a job for somebody. I mean, it is seriously one of the most exciting industries to be in at the moment. And the progression that we could make in this country is huge.
Is the money in it, though? I mean, like you say, there's jobs in it. Is it possible to pay people to do those jobs? That's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, we have, there is a wider societal debate to be had about that. Farming is obviously...
Price of food, price too cheap.
Yeah, and yes, the price of food is too cheap. You know, farming, as everybody is aware, is quite heavily subsidised. People argue that that subsidy is there to line the pockets of farmers. I would argue the subsidy is there to make food cheap for the consumers. But at the same time, as an industry, we do have an onus to look at how we are more efficient. And that isn't necessarily to mean that we need to cut corners, but there will be efficiency savings to make. Equally, you know, we have extremely high standards in this country. We produce Scotch beef and Scotch lamb that is the envy of the world, but there is a cost to producing that. You know, we need to recognize that, and the consumer needs to recognize that. Food as a percentage of household spend is relatively cheap compared to decades gone by, but equally there are significant parts of society that are reliant on food banks, and so we need to have a deeper, wider conversation about where we want our food market to be.
And of course, that's very current at the moment, what with all sorts of situations that I'm not even going to mention in this podcast, but but we're both smiling wryly, and it's a B word, and neither is going to say it.
Yeah, I know, but whether we mention that word or not, you know, we're looking at more global markets.
Yes.
We're looking at potentially one market that wants to bring primarily beef into this country. Yes. And, excuse me. And, you know, they're using some products in the rearing of their animals that were banned by Europe in the mid 80s.
I know they were.
And, you know, I'm all for competition. I'm all for a diverse cost base for food for the consumer. I mean, not everybody can afford to eat grass-fed prime fillet steak every night of the week. It's a question whether you should, but equally, just because you can't afford that, should you be forced to eat a product that is produced to a less, I'm going to say less safe standard, but it's maybe not the right phrase, but to a lower standard of our own food production in this country?
Everyone knows that beef that's produced in certain parts of the world is questionable.
I think that's the word, that it's questionable.
Questionable from an animal welfare perspective and from an eating perspective.
Certainly, I think we need to know more about it, because a lot of this is ramped up by the media. Certainly on face value, it's a much lower standard. The eating quality is an interesting one, because, you know, we constantly have it in this country within the farming press primarily. So, I mean, this maybe doesn't hit general consumers, but we have a grading system for all our carcasses, beef and pork and lamb, which it basically reports a price. So if you have a beast of a certain weight, carcass conformation, it will be given a grade and afforded a price. But there's no grading for quality in this country. America, Canada, New Zealand, Australia all have some indication of quality on their grading systems. And, you know, you may have come across USDA beef, and, you know, that is meant to be, that's their grading system, and they produce to an A1 standard, I think it is, and people absolutely rave about it. I'm not sure I would give you tuppence for it, but, you know, there are people that would say, oh, but American beef, it's so tender and it just melts in the mouth. That's fantastic, but there's no talk about how it's produced or other qualities like how it was fed. What does it taste of? You know, more and more we are used to beef, lamb, and probably especially pork as being flavor carriers. So rather than eating it in its own right, you mix it up into a curry, or you have a sauce with it. You do all these things. You introduce another flavor rather than having a product that the flavors will speak for itself.
Yeah, and that's quite common, isn't it? I mean, as a friend of mine always says that chicken doesn't taste like it used to when he was a kid, because they're all, the chickens he ate were wild chickens off the farm.
Yeah.
And tasted the chicken. Whereas chicken you buy anywhere else doesn't taste the chicken. But if you taste it, you'd probably hate it.
Yeah. And, it's interesting. In the shop, for example, we sell two types of chicken. We sell a barnyard chicken and we sell a free-range chicken. And, okay, the breed of the chicken from the free-range bird is slightly different. Well, it's a lot different. It's a slower-grown bird. But it is a completely different product. And we see it even more with the turkeys that we sell. You know, we have a barnyard turkey and we have a free-range, more traditional breed turkey. And again, the flavor profile is completely different. And yes, okay, one is more expensive than the other, but it's a completely different product. Mm. And no, I would argue you need both, because you have a variety of household budgets and, so you need both products, because you need to be able to provide food for people at different stages of the economic scale.
Yeah.
The common thing with all those products is they are all produced to the same high standard. Now, we can argue day and night as to whether a chicken should be in a shed or it should be outside. And, there'll be lots of different thoughts on that. But at the end of the day, so long as it is a safe product produced to very high welfare standards, there's room for both.
Mm. So moving on to your kind of success moving forward, what's success in the future for you?
Success in the future for me is based around two things: stable family, stable business, and both lead into one another. You know, we are at the moment in a position where we are running like fury, spinning lots of plates, but with three children growing up. On the one hand, the children are extremely lucky in that they are growing up in a wonderful environment, in a fantastic community, but equally their parents are run ragged and probably don't spend as much time with them as they would like, or the parents would like. So yeah, going forward, success will be a happy, stable family with stable business. You know, that's not to say that we won't be busy, but it's just a case of making sure that we're enjoying what we're doing and making time for each other.
Mm. Yeah, very valid indeed.
It's not hugely more complicated than that. I think that is, that is the goal. And at the moment, everything is full of compromises because we're having to change the businesses very rapidly in a period of very great change and uncertainty. And, that does play into it. But, as the kids grow up and, develop into young people, we want to be able to spend the time with them to do that.
Do you have a vision of them coming into the business, into the farm?
Do you know what? If they would like to, that would be brilliant. If they want to go and do something completely different, that's equally good too. I have a friend who would be extremely disappointed if one of his children didn't come into the business. And he keeps saying to me, "Oh, you'd be gutted if that didn't happen." But I really, really wouldn't. I hope that they grow up to be independent thinkers and people that will make their own life choices, hopefully sensible ones. And if that involves them coming back to the business, then that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
If they want to go and be brain surgeons or plumbers or whatever it might be, that's good too.
See, we talk about on this podcast quite a lot about the success model, because when I grew up, there was a success model that was accepted. And the success model was you study hard, you get exams, you go to college or university, you get a good job, you find a partner, you settle down, you get a house, you get a car, you then you retire. And that was the success model my parents are sold, and that was the model that I was sold. And modern people now don't have this success model now, because it doesn't work anymore, it's broken. And it's quite interesting to talk to people about different models and different processes. And yours is actually closer to the traditional success model. So do you ever see yourself retiring?
Oh, God, yes. absolutely. Well, retiring's maybe not the right word. Making time for doing the things that I enjoy doing, as long as I'm fit and able to do it.
Oh, God, we have to know what they are.
Well, it may be that when I get to 85, which will be the retirement age by the time I get there, you know, I'm still fit and able to farm in the small way that we do, and that I'm enjoying it.
Yes.
Now, it might be that there's a way of taking out a lot more of the gnaws and the grind that I don't enjoy doing, which means you can just spend more time doing the enjoyment stuff. Retirement for me is a funny word, A, because it's so far away in theory, and B, you know, retirement to me means you stop doing something, and I would rather see it as maybe changing what I do. And I would like to be in a position where we are freer to do the things that we want to do rather than doing things that we have to do. And yeah, there's going to be a mix of both of those things.
I think the retirement model has changed, because whenever the retirement was you stopped years ago, but nowadays I think retirement means you change career, you do something else. That's what I think modern retire, they just take on something, another project.
Yeah.
Why they're
able. And I think that's hugely valuable. You know, I think as a society now, we have come to rely on people that have maybe finished their main career in life that are contributing in other ways, whether that's voluntary or whether it's paid positions within organizations to bring in an experience level. But also probably more valuable is the time element that they can give. And, you know, that for me as well, that time might be to help the kids do what they want to do. If they're doing something, you know, because by the time I get to 60, Ayla will probably be in her mid-20s, I think. So, you know, and Tilly and Rory will be a couple of years behind that. So, you know, they'll be hopefully looking to settle down. One of them might be back here, maybe not. And so, you know, I would like the time to help them develop in what they do.
There was I saw a lovely video recently, which I actually posted on somewhere. For another project, and it was a race of older women racing, doing a 60 meter dash.
Right.
And the last lady to cross the line, she did it in 24 seconds, and she became a world record holder.
Right.
Because she crossed the line in 24 seconds. She's 102. And she only took up running when she was 100. She's the oldest woman to complete the 60 meter dash in 24 seconds.
Fantastic! Yeah, it just goes to show that, you know, you can still do these things. It's interesting. My grandfather will be 97 this year. You know, he retired at the age of 60. His retirement has almost been as long as his working life. Which I find fascinating.
But it's amazing, as you say, to have that such a longevity and have a longevity outside of the working environment.
Yeah, exactly. And it's great for him that he's been able to do that. Not everybody is so lucky or fortunate. But yeah, no, he's...
So I've got to the point where I give you an open question. So this is the question that I put to people. And the reason I put this question here is so that when we put the phone down, you don't go, oh, I wish I'd said so-and-so. So what is the question, the one question that I haven't asked you that I should have done?
I don't know what the question would be, but the one thing that's in my mind is going back to the kids. Yeah, the point that I maybe haven't made. We've got two girls and a boy, Ayla, Tilly and Rory. And one of the things I found interesting when Rory was born, and we'd moved up to the farm by then, was I had a lot of comments from people saying, you've got a boy, you'll be really pleased you've got somebody to take on the farm. I would point out to people, yes, but there's two girls in there that might also have a shout in it. Mm-hmm. And I think for all the progress society has made, we still have in certain sectors a thought process that it will be, that it's a man's job.
Yes.
And if I'm looking at my girls, I want them to have every opportunity to do what they want to do in whatever industry they want to do as a boy does. And I think that would be one of the things that I would really want to impress on our daughters, is not to set limits on what they think they can achieve just because society thinks that it's a boy's job. I don't know what the question is, but the answer is to sort of empower my daughters to achieve what they want to achieve.
Do you think, is farming particularly a sexist industry? I mean, it's a physical industry, I guess. So there is our physical limitations to this, but...
Yeah,
but
have you seen the size of tractors these days?
And, well, this is true.
You know, it's, yes, it's a physical industry, you know, but equally, where you might have brawn fixing a problem, brains can fix it as well.
Yes.
And it's just yourself.
There was that picture you posted on Facebook the day where one of your family was staring down a cow at the time, I think. it did look like, well, what happened next?
that was a picture of Dad. It's a picture that I found on the computer, and the title of the file is Murderous Cow. Is the industry sexist? I'm probably the wrong person to ask that, because I'm not on the receiving end of any sexism. But is there a prejudice against women doing certain jobs in the industry? Yeah, I would have thought so. So, and you know, it is still a very much a male dominated.
There are industries that are bastions of it. I guess the oil industry is probably the same on some level, and a lot of these heavy industries historically, where they come from that place, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, it is, and yeah, we have some fantastic role models, female role models now in the industry. You know, two ladies up in at Bigton Farm in Shetland, you know, who are on This Farming Life at the moment, have done wonders for the industry in showing that it's not just a male dominated job. It wasn't something I'd ever really thought of before, until Rory was born, and I started getting comments like that.
So, well, it's good that you noticed it and are highlighting it. And I hope when people do make it, those comments, you point it back at them.
Well, it's something that I'd never really thought of before, because you know, the wider family, Mum was always heavily involved in the farm, and particularly the butcher's shop. My aunt farms and runs an estate down in Perthshire. She has taken that on to my grandmother, you know, would regularly, she'd be looking after her cows and things like that. So I come from a family of very strong female role models. You know, my wife is very active. She's away at the moment, lambing on the West Coast. So I come from a family where it's it's not really an issue. Everybody can do anything. And so it wasn't highlighted to me until Rory came along. Mm. And more of a realization that those were maybe some of the barriers that would be put up in front of Ayla and Tilly. Mm-hmm.
So I've got to the point in the podcast where I allow people, how people can get in touch with you. And because you're a different business than most of the people I ever talk to, a lot of it are online businesses, but you do have an online aspect to your business. I know that your butcher's business sells meat online. Do you sell across the world? Do you dispatch meat anywhere?
No, at the moment we're UK only. We have dabbled with trying to put it into Europe, but because of our location and transit times, it's just not been possible. And we now go back to the B word again and to what happened there. So at the moment, we're just UK only. Okay.
My American listeners cannot enjoy your fantastic Scottish beef.
Unfortunately, not yet.
And they can't compare it to their local homegrown produce.
No, they'll just have to come and visit the country and see how wonderful Scotland is, and then they can sample the fine produce.
Well, I will put links to your online shop and that sort of stuff. And also, how do people get in touch with you if they wanted to?
We have through social media or through email. We have Facebook pages for both our farm, Edenvale Farm, and for the shop, Macbeth. Twitter, email, through the website.
Okay, all those links will be on there anyway.
All of those links. I'm happy to talk to anybody.
Good, no problem at all. So I get to the final question that I ask all my guests, and it's a kind of a real self-reflective question, really, because we are animals at the end of the day. We come on this earth, and it's only humans that think we are more important than the other animals around them. However, everyone has a viewpoint. So what is, for you, what is the meaning of life? Why are we here, or why are you here?
The reason I am here, in my mind, is to make something better than I found it. And it doesn't matter what it is. I want to leave something. I want to improve it or leave it better than what it was. Whether that's a business, whether it's a family situation. Yeah, I want to be in a position where I can say, that was better than when I got it. Now, do I succeed in those things? Hell no. It's something that I'm very conscious of, that to try and improve something, I will actually make something else worse. I find that difficult, and when you're having to compromise something else to improve another situation. But that is my main aim, is to leave something behind that was better than when I got it.
And that's the meaning of life for you?
Yeah.
Fantastic. So, Joel Gibson, thank you so much for your time today. It has been a pleasure to talk to you. And really, really eye-opening to have a conversation with someone that has such a real visceral connection with the food that we eat.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on.
Lovely. Thank you.
Yes.
And that was Life, Passion and Business with Paul Harvey and my guest, Jock Gibson. If you are in the UK, you are in the lucky position to have the option to buy some of Jock's produce from his online shop at macbeths.com. The link, as always, will be on the podcast website in lifepassionandbusiness.com, and as are the other links for finding Jock on social media, both in LinkedIn and on Facebook. So as I said at the beginning of this program, Change Your World Every Day is now open. And if you would like to take part in an online coaching program that takes you forward towards your goals, this is a fantastic opportunity. So please check out the website, Life, Passion and Business, and you'll find the details there. Or go straight to changeyourworld.me and you'll find the details there. And that brings me to the end of the program. So thank you so much for making it right to the end of the show. If you can leave a review or do some likes or comments, it would be most appreciated. And if you can share us, that would also be appreciated. Anyway, that's it for today. Thank you so much for your time and attention, and I will catch you next time.